8 verses, which indicate that he gave Krishna's name and Balaram his names, and described who they were in their past lives, and described that for Krishna, he didn't disclose everything, because he didn't want to disturb the heart of Nanda, that your son is the personality of Godhead. So he said, he will have power like Narayana. He didn't say he was Narayana. He didn't say he wasn't. He just said he'll have powers like Narayana. With those powers, he'll protect the Vrijbasis, so you should take good care of him. So that ended the discussion. He has powers like Narayana. And that's what Gargamudi said is true. So let's have a festival. So they had a festival in honor of Krishna and Nanda Maharaj. And that was... So because those 8 prayers, which not prayers, 8 verses came from chapter 8, from the childhood, the name-giving ceremony, we went back to chapter 8. And so we covered those verses again, and then what happened after that, what happened after that. And one of the things that Makhanchur Leela, Krishna's stealing of butter, the butter thief pastimes, are described in the chapter 8. It's really nice, very sweet. And then the acharyas describe what Krishna wanted was the experience of the motherly affection of Mother Jasoda to scold him. Now, most children don't want to be scolded. But it's part of affection when loving parents are scolding their children. It's not because they like the power play. They have affection for their children, and some things need to be corrected. So Krishna was stealing, and he wanted his mother to correct him, and she just embraced him. So then he figured out a way to get him to scold her, get her to scold him, the eating dirt pastime. So whether he ate dirt or didn't eat dirt, his friend said he ate dirt, and Mother Jasoda was alarmed and scolded him. And he said, they're liars, I didn't eat dirt. And if you want to, don't believe me, you can look in my mouth. So Krishna opened his mouth, and Mother Jasoda looked in Krishna's mouth. This is chapter 8. And you know what she saw? She saw the whole universe. Because scripture teaches us that everything is within God. And he showed her. He expanded power, potency, because God has unlimited potencies. And he showed everything is within him, including the mountains and planets and rivers and all species of life and etc. The whole universe's worth of stuff was in Krishna's mouth, including Mother Jasoda looking inside Krishna's mouth. Inside Krishna's mouth. Everything was there. And she went, whew. What happened? Maybe I'm dreaming. And then she ruled out, you know, I'm not dreaming, I'm wide awake. Maybe this is a potency of the demigods to bewilder me. Why would the demigod, Deva Maya, why would they bother with me? Maybe I'm deranged, I've just gone mad. No, my thinking process is quite normal. So maybe it's, and the fourth one was, maybe this is a power of Narayan, like Gargamuni said, during this name-giving ceremony. And so then she started praying to Narayan to protect her son. And her motherly affection, there's more detail, but her motherly affection just went way up. Krishna showed his opulence to create this astonishment purposefully. And then another mood of love is the mood of her maternal affection. And the narrator, Shukadeva Goswami, says, her love is so excellent that the scriptures teach understanding God this way, other scriptures teach that way, other scriptures teach that way, but she's beyond all that. She just sees Krishna as her son, how strong is her affection? Inconceivable. She's a very special being. And Nanda Maharaj as well. So then there's this discussion. The hearer is the king, Shukadev, excuse me, Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit goes, wow. What did they do in their previous lives to get this kind of elevated consciousness? And then he says, they're even more fortunate than Vasudev and Devaki who gave birth because they didn't experience his childhood pastimes. Look at what Nanda and Yashoda have. All this wonderful experience. They're Mahabhaga. They're most fortunate. So then there's some discussion about the response to that without going into detail. The essence of that chapter 8 is parental affection. Childhood pastimes, naturally, the parents are most involved. There's not so much discussion yet with Krishna's friends, the Sakya Rasa, the friendship. It's Vatsalya, parental affection. Both the cowherd men, the cowherd women with lots and lots of details, and the super exalted position of Nanda Yashoda. So that's chapter 8. We skip chapter 9 and 10 because 9 and 10 is the Damodar Leela. And again, it's the super excellence of Mother Yashoda's love. That's where the picture goes. And then after she binds him with rope, although she couldn't then find, he allows her to bind him, she binds him with her love, not with the rope. Then she goes about her household duties, and Krishna sees the two trees in the courtyard of Nanda and Yashoda, the Yamala Arjun trees, and now he's again in the mood not of a small child, but he's in the mood of personality of Godhead. Narada Muni made a pledge. He gave his word that these two sons of Kuvera, who had become really intoxicated with pride because of being very wealthy and very dear to Lord Shiva, and they were so proud that they needed their pride to be checked. They offended Narada Muni. So they became trees and that Krishna would deliver you. So Narada said that, so Krishna looks at the trees. Okay, time to deliver the sons of Kuvera. So the rope was tied around his waist, and the other end of the rope was tied around a wooden grinding mortar. Now we don't use those, but for grinding spices, there's a grinding mortar. So he started crawling, toddling, and the grinding mortar fell in between the two trees, and he uprooted the two trees. And, you know, the roots were in huge trees, and I don't know the detail, but I've been told by persons that know about trees in India, an Arjun tree is harder than oak wood. It's like particularly known to be hard wood. It's good for, you know, when you need hard wood, like these chairs or something, probably oak trees or something. So the roots were completely uprooted. I mean, what kind of machine can uproot a whole tree and all of its root system? It's doable, but it's like major. And then when the trees crashed, made a big sound, and two Nalukovera Manigriva came out, demigod forms, offered prayers to Krishna, thanked him for relieving them of the tree body, and Narada's kindness for relieving them of their pride, and they requested permission. Krishna didn't speak anything. They just requested permission to return. Krishna acknowledged, and they went. And that's where chapter 10 ends, 9 and 10, the Damodara Leela and the deliverance of the two trees. So next is what happens. So what happened is Nanda Maharaj, heard the big crash of the trees. And he came running. And the others from Braja, they also came running to find out, wow, what was that? And then what they saw were these very large trees with big holes in the ground where the root system was, and the roots sticking up in the air, and the branches, you know, they couldn't even see Krishna because the branches were all over the place. It's like, you know, very dangerous. And so then they start reacting, or like, well, we'll hear what they say. That's where we are. Chapter 9. Can you, chapter 11. Text 3. 10, 11, 3. Krishna was bound by the rope to the ulukala, or the mortar, which he was dragging. But how could he have pulled down the trees? Who had actually done it? Where was the source for the incident? Considering all these astonishing things, the cowherd men were doubtful and bewildered. Purport. The cowherd men were very much agitated because the child Krishna, after all, had been standing between the two trees. And if by chance the trees had fallen upon him, he would have been smashed. But he was standing as he was, and still the things had happened. So who had done all this? How could these events have happened in such a wonderful way? These considerations were some of the reasons that they were agitated and bewildered. They thought, however, that by chance Krishna had been saved by God, so that nothing had happened to him. Now I'm going to read from commentaries. This one, first one is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Though they could understand from the situation that the boy had caused the two Arjuna trees to fall because of prema or avijaya, they could not think that it was so. They doubted that such a small boy could do such a thing. They expressed their doubts in these verses. Quote, who has done this? For what reason has this amazing accident happened to the boy? Thinking in this way, they were filled with pain. By our good fortune, the boy is protected by the Lord. And another commentator, Sanatan Goswami, comments on this verse. How did these two trees, big as a cowherd's house, fall without wind or rain, without being struck by lightning, without being attacked by elephants? Paragraph. What they understood is described. They saw the child there also, pulling the mortar vigorously. Vikarshanam. He was tied by a rope to the mortar. This description hides his power with the understanding that he was not strong. The word cha indicates that they saw the marks of pulling the mortar between the two trees. They could not understand what happened because he was just a small boy. Balakam. A small baby could not do this act. This would become clear later. This was astonishing. Who or what made the tree fall and why? If the devatas or the demons did it, why? They did it. They concluded it was a disaster. They became disturbed, worrying about the safety of the child. And now the next text is 10, 11, 4. So that when Krishna did this, he was with his friends, little boys. So the little boys tell what happened. Then all the cowherd boys said, "It is Krishna who has done this." They're pointing to him. When he was in between the two trees, the mortar fell crosswise. Krishna dragged the mortar, and the two trees fell down. After that, two beautiful men came out of the trees. We have seen this with our own eyes. Purport. Krishna's playmates wanted to inform Krishna's father of the exact situation by explaining that not only did the trees break, but out of the broken trees came two beautiful men. All these things happened, they said. We have seen them with our own eyes. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, the other boys said, Krishna went between the trees, pulling the mortar sideways. As the boys were filled with fear, they could not tell the complete story. They did not tell that the trees fell down. The elders did not believe the story. Therefore, the boys said again, we saw two men emerge from the trees. Sound like a little kid's story to the adults. Jiva Goswami writes, pointing out Krishna covered in the leaves, the boys spoke on their own without being asked. He did it. Out of excitement, they did not even say the complete sentence, such as, he pulled down the trees. How did he do it? He pulled the mortar sideways between the trees. The boys were bewildered by the sweetness of Damodar. And one more, text 5 from chapter 11. Because of intense parental affection, the cowherd men headed by Nanda could not believe that Krishna could have uprooted the trees in such a wonderful way. Therefore, they could not put their faith in the words of the boys. Some of the men, however, were in doubt. Quote, since Krishna was predicted to be equal to Narayana, they thought, it might be. They could have done it. Purport. One view was that it was impossible for a small boy like this to have done such a thing as pulling down the trees. But there were doubts because Krishna had been predicted to be equal to Narayan. Therefore, the cowherd men were in a dilemma. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes his commentary. Nanda and the cowherd men could not believe what the children said, for because of their feelings for Krishna, they could not think further about Krishna having great powers. Others, remembering what Garga had said, your child will have qualities like Narayana, with the rise of affection for Krishna, they became uncertain. Maybe it was true. And Jiva Goswami writes, Nanda and others could not believe what the children said because their hearts were soft with attachment to Krishna. Even some brahmanas with somewhat hard hearts, after considering the death of Putana and other demons, were doubtful of the children because their hearts were also softened with natural possessiveness. And I want to spend some time explaining this. Softened with natural possessiveness. We'll come back. Their natural affection increased by seeing Krishna's astonishing powers suddenly manifesting, just as, though other tastes enter the salt ocean, the ocean salt becomes saltier. The reason their affection increased was that they considered Krishna a small child, and they had deep affection for him. Thus, they did not ask directly to the children to extinguish their doubts. They could not ask questions because they were overcome with affection. And Sanatan Goswami writes, Nanda and others could not believe the children's words. because their hearts were overcome with great affection. The priests and others were doubtful. Though sometimes he displayed his powers to them, their love did not decrease, but rather by the event it increased. And he makes this interesting comment. When fire in the Kandava forest increased, rain could not extinguish it. Rather, the shower increased the flames like adding ghee. I'm going to do it again because this is important. When fire in the Kandava forest increased, rain could not extinguish it. Rather, the shower increased the flames like adding ghee. It's a nice metaphor. What I want to do is read the section from Mahabharata about the Kandava forest. It's in the Bhagavatam also, but it's more detail in Mahabharata. So, before I go to the pastime, I'll explain two things. The comparison to the Kandava forest being burned and rain couldn't extinguish it relates to the feelings of affectionate love that the residents of Vrindavan had for Krishna. It's like the Kandava forest burning. And some things would come that could extinguish that forest fire, that love, like Krishna showing his powers. But it didn't result in extinguishing the fire or their love. It served to increase their love. So I'll explain. In the previous section, chapter 8, towards the end, as I mentioned, there's this glorification of Nanda and Jasoda and their love of Nanda and Jasoda for Krishna. And so in the spiritual world, we go back to this, what's the spiritual world like? In the spiritual world, there's Krishna Loka. There's Vaikuntha planets, the abodes of Narayan, and there's the abode of Krishna, Krishna Loka. And Krishna Loka exists eternally. It's not created and annihilated like anything of this world. And Krishna's engaged in pastimes there eternally. So eternally, Nanda and Jasoda are there. It's described that they're expansions of Krishna's own form. They're not living entities or jivas like us. They're Krishna's direct energetic expansions. And they embody parental affection towards Krishna because according to the Vedas, the Shruti mantras say, raso vai saha. The absolute truth is rasa. Within Krishna is everything. So the different relationships that exist have their foundation within Krishna, and Nanda Jasoda have that affection to the nth degree, unlimited degree. And when Krishna performs pastimes in this world, the presence of Nanda Jasoda expand the affection of all the others with whom they associate because they have it to an unlimited degree. So mentioning here is that the brahmanas, because they're very learned, and sometimes knowledge may diminish affection. When you live together, you're a family of five, and you know each other inside and out because you live together. This one's like this, and that one's like that, and you understand each other's nature and so forth. You know everything about one another. And there's an intimacy in family dealings. And somebody like Prabhupada gives this example of the Prime Minister of England was once, there was an appointment, somebody had to see him. And when they went to see him, and the secretary said he was busy. It took a whole big deal to get the appointment to see the Prime Minister. So he's sitting in the, you know, the waiting room for half an hour and 2 hours and 2.5 hours passed. He was getting agitated. So when the secretary wasn't looking, he just snuck inside. And when he snuck inside to see the Prime Minister, his grandson was on his back hitting him, saying, you know, horsey, get up. And then the Prime Minister is going, hey, you know, the horse. So the intimacy of the affection, when there's closeness, it can't be understood by the display of might and power and opulence and majesty. It's a different mood. There's an intimacy in Vrindavan that the majesty of God that doesn't go well. They don't fit. It's the same person, the Prime Minister and his grandson. They, you know, the public sees the Prime Minister one way and the grandson sees him another way. So when the Brahmanas, knowing scripture and seeing things through the eyes of scripture the way that they do, it might diminish when Krishna shows his opulence. It might diminish their natural affection. The point is being made, it increased their natural affection. Using this metaphor of the Khandava forest. And when the Khandava forest was burning, there was an attempt by Indra to put it out, but it didn't work. There's some, specifically it says here, rather than decreasing the flames, it increased the flames, like adding ghee to fire. So I'm going to read, if you don't mind. It's very nice. The burning of the Khandava forest. This is a section, a rendering of Mahabharata that's really nicely written. And it comes chronologically after Arjuna's marriage to Subhadra. Subhadra was the younger sister. Balaram, the older brother. Krishna in the middle, and Vasudeva and Devaki had one daughter, Subhadra. So the first six sons were killed by Kamsa. Balaram was number 7. Krishna was number 8. And then there was a younger sister, Subhadra. So now they're in Dwarka. And without the long story, the short of it is, Arjuna kidnapped Subhadra at the time of her wedding, and there was a big confrontation about that. But in short, in Dwarka, Subhadra was married to Arjuna with Krishna's presence and Balaram's presence. And after the marriage, then Subhadra is now coming back to where the Pandavas stay. Hastinapur, presumably. And there's a big festival. And during the big festival, gifts are exchanged. There's an elaborate discussion. And then the Yadus get ready to return back to Dwarka. Because when the girl is married, after the marriage, she's married in her place. And then there's a procession to take her, arrangement to bring her to her new home. With her husband. So I'm just going to read the call, the burning of the Khandava forest. With Balaram at the head, the Yadus headed back to Dwarka, but Krishna decided to remain behind to spend some time alone with Arjuna. One day Arjuna suggested, "Oh Krishna, the days are hot. Let us go for some time to the banks of the Yamuna. We have constructed many fine pleasure houses there." Krishna agreed to his proposal and they set off. They soon arrived at a charming spot amid groves of tall trees. High white mansions stood along the river banks, looking like a city of the gods. Krishna and Arjuna entered one of the houses, where there were served varieties of exquisitely flavored food and drinks. They lay down upon golden couches, spread with silk covers. After relaxing for some time, they decided to go for a walk in the woods. The two heroes wandered along the riverbank, discussing martial arts and past battles they had each fought. Having walked for a distance, they sat down upon an ivory bench that had been placed near the edge of a dense forest. As they continued to talk, a Brahmin suddenly emerged from the woods. They looked at him in surprise. He resembled an old sal tree with a complexion like molten gold. His beard and hair were bright yellow, and he shone like the morning sun. His two eyes were like lotus leaves, and his body was well-formed and powerful. As the Brahmin approached them, blazing like fire, Krishna and Arjuna stood up and awaited his order. In a resonant voice, the Brahmin said, "I know you two to be the foremost of all men. I myself am a voracious Brahmin who eats much. I have therefore approached you in order to beg my food and be gratified by you." Both Krishna and Arjuna folded their palms and asked the Brahmin what food he would like. The Brahmin replied, "I do not eat ordinary food. Know me to be Agni, the fire god. Give me food that suits me. Please help me devour this Khandava forest." He indicated with gesture the jungle by which they were standing. Although he had already made attempts to consume the forest, his efforts had been repeatedly thwarted by Indra. This was because Indra's friend, the Naga Takshaka, not used to sitting on the floor. The Naga Takshaka. The Nagas, it's described elsewhere in Mahabharata, that the Nagas are down in the lower regions of this universe. They're not lower beings, they're just, that's where their residence is. And the Naga Takshaka resided there. I don't want to get too distracted. When Bhima was tied up by ropes and thrown into the Ganges, he went to the realm of the Nagas. Anyway, and Takshaka was there. So now Takshaka's in this Khandava forest. Whenever Agni blazed up and began to cover the forest, Indra would send torrents of rain to stop him. The fire god continued, "Both of you are experts in arms. By your prowess, you will be able to prevent Indra from stopping me. Thus, I shall consume this great forest, O heroes. This is the food I desire to have from you." Krishna and Arjuna looked at each other in surprise. They assured Agni that they would do everything in their power to help him, but they were curious as to why he wanted to consume this particular forest. The deity explained that the Khandava forest contained numerous varieties of medicinal herbs. He needed the herbs because he was suffering a malady due to having eaten excessive amounts of ghee. There had been a great sacrifice performed by a king named Swetaki, in which so much ghee was offered into the fire that Agni became ill. Brahma then told him that he could be cured if he ate the herbs in the Khandava forest. When Agni failed in his attempts to consume the forest, Brahma again told him that he would succeed if he could gain the assistance of Krishna and Arjuna. Brahma had said, quote, in a previous incarnation, these two were in fact the ancient and infallible deities Nara and Narayana. They have appeared on earth to accomplish the celestial's purpose. Therefore, ask for their help. Agni concluded, I now depend upon you too. I must eat this forest. Brahma has also informed me that the living beings within the forest are sinful and should be destroyed. Therefore, do not harbor any doubts. This act is sanctioned by authority. Arjuna replied, I possess many celestial weapons, but I have no bow capable of bearing their power. If I am to achieve the task you have set, I will require an inexhaustible quiver of arrows and a chariot drawn by celestial steeds. If you can provide all this, then we will surely accomplish your desire. Agni meditated upon Varuna, the god of the nether worlds, and the deity immediately appeared and said, What shall I do for you? Agni knew that Varuna kept many celestial weapons in the depths of the ocean. Therefore, Agni asked him to present Arjuna with celestial bow Gandiva, as well as two inexhaustible quivers of arrows. Agni also asked that Varuna bring forth a chariot belonging to Soma, the moon god. Varuna agreed and caused all these things to appear at that spot. Arjuna looked with wonder at the Gandiva bow. It appeared like a rainbow, embedded with celestial gems. As tall as a man, it was flawless. The Pandava took up the shining bow and forcefully twanged its string. A sound like the crash of thunder resounded throughout the forest, terrifying all the creatures. Holding the bow, the joyful Arjuna next approached the huge golden chariot. It was filled with a variety of celestial weapons as well as two inexhaustible quivers Agni had requested. The chariot was yoked with golden harnesses to silvery steeds from the land of the Gandharvas. These horses were capable of going anywhere within all the worlds and could move with the speed of the wind or the mind. Above the chariot flew a banner bearing an image of Hanuman, Rama's great monkey servant. Hanuman seemed to be burning everything that fell within his gaze. Other flags flew on the chariot bearing images of fierce beasts. All the creatures roared terribly from their standards. Arjuna circumambulated the chariot and then mounted it like a virtuous man ascending to heaven. He put on the suit of celestial armor that lay there. As he stood with the Gandiva in his hand, he resembled the sun shining from behind an evening cloud. He then drove the chariot around, smiling as he heard the loud rumble of its wheels. Varuna also gave Krishna a club named Kaumodaki, name of Krishna's club, which roared loudly when wheeled about and which could crush even Daityas and Danavas. Krishna then mounted Arjuna's chariot, saying that he would become the driver. This happened even before Kurukshetra battle. Arjuna again addressed Agni. Oh, fire god, we are now ready to satisfy your request. Armed with a Gandiva and assisted by Krishna, I am able to withstand the entire host of gods united with the Asuras. What then to speak of Indra? Therefore, blaze up as much as you like and surround this forest. Paragraph. Agni immediately expanded himself around the forest and began to consume it with his seven kinds of flames. He assumed the fearful appearance he assumes at the end of an eon which he uses to destroy all things. Krishna then began to drive the chariot around the forest. It moved with such speed that it appeared to be continuously present on every side of the forest. Whenever Arjuna saw a creature trying to escape from the conflagration, he immediately shot it down. Being slain in the presence of Krishna, the supreme deity, all the creatures dying in that forest assumed spiritual forms and ascended to the highest regions of transcendence. Paragraph. The roar of the fire could be heard for miles. Red, orange, and blue flames shot high into the sky. The lakes and ponds in the forest were boiled dry and the rocks melted. No creature was able to escape from the blazing Kandava forest, and their screams mixed with the crackling of the fire. It blazed up to such an extent that it caused fear even to the celestials, who went in a body to Indra and said anxiously, "Oh, Lord of the immortals, why does Agni burn all creatures below? Has the time come for the world's destruction?" Indra looked himself to see what was happening on the earth. Feeling concerned for his friend, Takshaka, he set out at once to stop the fire. He sent down torrents of rain, which fell in columns as thick as tree trunks. But the rain was turned to steam by the heat of the fire, even before it reached the forest below. Indra then became angry and amassed huge clouds over the forest, which doubled the volume of rain. With its flames and smoke rising up, and with lightning and sheets of water falling from the sky, the forest became terrifying. Paragraph. Arjuna saw Indra's attempt to put out the fire, and he sent hundreds of thousands of arrows in a tight network over the forest. That net of arrows acted as a vast umbrella and completely checked the falling rain. What's next? The Naga king, Takshaka, was not present in the Kandava, but both his wife and son were caught in the blaze. They flew swiftly upwards and were seen by Arjuna. He instantly fired an arrow which severed the snake lady's head. He then trained another arrow upon Takshaka's son, Asvasena. Seeing this, Indra raised a violent wind around Arjuna, which temporarily deprived him of his senses. Asvasena escaped and disappeared into the sky. Paragraph. As he regained his senses, Arjuna became angry with Indra. He shouted a challenge to the god and covered the sky with his arrows. Indra too became angry with Arjuna and released his tremendous thunderbolt weapon. Without any delay, Arjuna invoked the Vayavya weapon, which dispersed the huge black clouds. It's a wind weapon. That powerful wind weapon completely dispelled the energy of Indra's thunderbolts and lightning flashes. The sky became clear, and a gentle breeze began to blow. Agni blazed up even more, fanned by the breeze, and fed with the fat of bodies burning in the forest. He filled the sky with roars. Paragraph. Indra summoned many other celestials to fight with Arjuna. Hosts of powerful heavenly fighters appeared and began to send their weapons at both him and Krishna. Blazing iron balls, bullets, rockets, and countless arrows shot towards them. Arjuna countered all the missiles with his arrows. At the same time, he cut down his assailants, who fell screaming into the fire. Arjuna was unconquerable as he stood on the battlefield, releasing deadly arrows, with Krishna skillfully guiding the chariot. battle scenes. I've learned that young boys like the battle scenes a lot. It's their favorite. Maybe you're too old. You read it? Oh, you read it. Okay.
Yeah, he has the Amar Chitrakatha version of Mahabharata.
Okay.
So he is right.
This is a little more... The language is really, it's well written.
Yes,
this version. Book. This version. I don't know, the comic book. Okay, so then Indra mounted his celestial elephant Airavata and rushed down upon Arjuna and Krishna shouting, "These two are killed." He raised his personal weapon known as the Vajra and urged on his elephant, seeing Indra advance. The other principal gods followed him. Yamaraj took up his death-dealing club, Kuvera his mace, Vruna his noose. Interesting, because Vruna gave Arjuna all these things. The commander of the celestial army, Skanda, raised his Shakti weapon, and Surya came with his brilliant dart. The other gods charged behind Indra with their own weapons raised. The Vishvadevas, Sadyas, Rudras, Vasus, and Marutas all advanced in a body toward Arjuna and Krishna, who stood fearlessly below. Even though they exerted themselves with full force, however, the celestials were unable to overpower Krishna and Arjuna. Struck by Arjuna's mystical arrows, the gods were forced to retreat. Indra smiled. He was pleased with Arjuna, who was, after all, his son. And he also understood Krishna's position. Indra knew that no one could overcome Krishna or anyone supported by him. Obviously, Krishna desired that Agni consume the forest. And, at the same time, he was enhancing the fame and the glory of his friend Arjuna. Then, desiring to test Arjuna's power further, Indra sent down a thick shower of boulders. Arjuna quickly reduced the stones to dust with his swift arrows. Indra then tore off the peak of a massive mountain and hurled it at Arjuna. Not disturbed in the least, Arjuna cut the flying mountain peak into 1,000 pieces, which rained down upon the forest below. Indra was gladdened by Arjuna's prowess. He ordered the celestials to withdraw, and as he did so, an invisible voice was heard in the sky. "Oh, Indra, your friend Takshaka is not in the forest at present, nor will it be possible for you to defeat in battle Arjuna and Krishna. These two are Nara and Narayana, the immortal and invisible rishis. They are worthy of even the gods' worship. Desire from the battle, desist from the battle, for the burning of the Kandava has been ordained by fate." Paragraph. Having heard that voice, which they knew belonged to the universal creator Brahma, the gods retired to their own abodes. For 15 days, Agni continued to consume the forest along with its inhabitants. As the forest was destroyed, hordes of Rakshasas, Danavas, and Nagas rushed out in fear. Arjuna cut them down with volleys of arrows. None could even look at him as he stood releasing his searing shafts. Gradually, the forest was reduced to ashes, and Agni was gratified. And it's not over yet. Maya Danava. There was a leader of the Asura race named Maya, who had been dwelling in the Kandava. Having hid himself underground, he now rushed out of the forest and tried to escape. Agni chased the Asura, and Krishna raised his discus weapon, Sudarshana, ready to kill him. The intelligent Maya ran to Arjuna and fell at his feet. "Oh, Arjuna, I seek your protection. Save me. I supplicate myself before you." Arjuna raised his hand and replied, "Do not fear." He could not refuse to protect anyone who sought his shelter. He turned toward Krishna and asked him to spare the Asura's life. Krishna lowered his weapon, and Agni stood back. As the flames of the forest died down, Indra again appeared before Arjuna and Krishna. Agni stood next to him and said, "O Partha, O Keshava, you have achieved that which could not be achieved by any celestial. Please ask for me any boon you desire. I am very much pleased." Arjuna asked Indra for all his celestial weapons. Indra smiled and replied that he would indeed give him all his weapons, but not yet. When Shiva would give Arjuna his Pashupat weapon, then Indra would bring him to heaven and give him all the fire and wind weapons. That time would come in the future. Krishna then asked that his friendship with Arjuna might last forever. And Indra said, "It shall be so." Finally, Agni said, "I also wish to give you a boon. Just as I pervade this universe, so by my power, you will be able to go anywhere you desire within the universe." The gods then returned to the heavens. As Krishna and Arjuna made their way back to their mansion, Maya approached them. He bowed at Arjuna's feet and said, "O son of Kunti, you have saved me from the angry Krishna and the hungry Agni. Tell me what I can do for you in return." Arjuna replied, "I cannot take anything from you to repay me. This is my firm principle. I act only out of duty. It was my duty to save you, and therefore you bear me no obligation. Go in peace." Maya praised Arjuna's virtue, but he insisted upon doing something for the Pandavas. "I simply wish to please you, O Partha. You need not see it as repayment." Arjuna again said he would not accept anything from Maya. "I do not want to frustrate your desire. You want to please me? Then do something for Krishna. That will be more pleasing to me than anything else." Maya turned and looked expectantly at Krishna, who was smiling softly. After reflecting for a moment, Krishna said, "You are the architect of the celestial demons. If you wish to please me, then build a splendid assembly hall for Yudhisthira. The like of this hall should not be found anywhere in the world. It should contain features of celestial architecture and be impossible for anyone else to emulate." The Asura's skills were well known to Krishna. Maya had constructed wondrous edifices in the higher planets for the Daityas and Danavas. Maya then assented to Krishna's request and accompanied him and Arjuna back to Indraprastha, where he was introduced to Yudhisthira. The eldest Pandava marveled as Arjuna narrated the story of how the Kandava forest was burnt. He received Maya with honor and discussed the hall with him. After much thought, Maya drew up a design. He then began to consider where to find the necessary materials for constructing the celestial hall. He told the Pandavas that he needed to go to the Himalayas. "I have left there a large quantity of rough diamonds and other precious stones of every description, including those not found on this earth. I shall go to fetch them." Maya explained that he had formerly been engaged by Vrishaparva, the king of the Danavas, to construct sacrificial altars for the Asuras. He had gathered all kinds of celestial materials, which he had stored at Vrishaparva's house, high up in the Mainaka mountain. There was also a great club, which Vrishaparva had once withstood the gods in battle. Maya would bring that club, equal to 100,000 ordinary clubs, and give it to Bhima. You know the story. Pretty, it matches, right? He would also fetch from the depths of a lake on Mainapa a large celestial conch shell known as Devadatta for Arjuna. You know, at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, they blew their conch shells and Arjuna's conch was Devadatta. And Krishna's name, his conch shell? Panchajanya. That he got when he was looking for this. Anyway. If Arjuna blew that conch on the battlefield, it would shatter his opponent's hearts. Last paragraph. Having gained Yudhisthira's permission, the Asura left quickly for the north. He found all his wealth guarded by Yakshas and Rakshasas, and with their assistance, he brought it back to Indraprastha. After presenting the club to Bhima and the conch shell to Arjuna, he commenced work. And that's the kind of a forest burning reference. So now let's go back to chapter 11 of Canto 10. This is Krishna pulling over the twin Arjuna trees, and the brahmanas saw the Aishvarya, the opulence that Krishna had within him. And while they saw the opulence, it didn't diminish, it served to enhance their affection for Krishna. And you know, going back a step further, the affection that they had for Krishna was the natural association that came from Nanda and Yashoda. Nanda and Yashoda's love for Krishna is unequaled. And by that association, all the residents of Braja were influenced by that association, by that mood of love. The kind of mood of love in Vrindavan is, even when Krishna shows opulence, their loving mood of intimacy of love, madhurya, sweetness of love, is so overpoweringly strong, they can't really comprehend and hold in their minds that Krishna is the all opulent supreme source of everything, even when he shows it. It's the nature of the love of Vrindavan. And now, one last thing, it's because I mentioned it, this, our acharyas commonly use this terminology, possessiveness. I'll read the sentence again. Even some brahmanas with somewhat hard hearts, after considering the death of Putana and other demons, were doubtful of the children, their story, what happened, because their hearts were also softened with natural possessiveness. So it's natural possessiveness is not a term that Prabhupada commonly used, but it's a term that the acharyas who are speaking about rasa, or the mellows of love, speak about. And so there's a worldly possessiveness and there's an otherworldly possessiveness. The worldly possessiveness is rooted in the bodily conception of life. I am this body. So what's mine, my possessions, is what's generated from this body. My wealth, my family, my bank balance, things that my money can buy, that's mine. And that the possessiveness, the I and mine, aham and mama, make up materialistic perspective on what's happiness and what's my experience of existence. Is based on a material sense of proprietorship or possessiveness. And one of the four essential books in our Bhakti Shastri study, you've heard of the Bhakti Shastri study, right? There's four essential books that Prabhupada indicated one should know to understand the Bhakti process. It's part of Bhagavad Gita. Nectar of Instruction, Nectar of Devotion, and Sri Aisho Upanishad. Sri Aisho Upanishad It's the foremost of the 108 principal Upanishads, and its topic is proprietorship. It's all about who's the owner of everything. And the owner of everything is where everything comes from. That's who the owner is. Because Krishna is the source of everything. He is the proprietor of everything. And one who lives their life recognizing he is the proprietor of everything lives very happily. They utilize things that's meant for them to utilize, knowing that Krishna is the proprietor of those things, and they don't take other things knowing well to whom they belong. That's the first mantra of Ishopanishad. Isavashamidam sarvam. So there's a spiritual sense of proprietorship. That's what's being spoken of in terms of rasa. And that is, they see I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. Not in the material sense of mine, but in the sense of that's all that I have. All that I have is my relationship with Krishna and he's my everything. And there isn't something else. Like Prahlad Maharaj says in his prayers to Lord Nrisingadev, please don't ask me for a benediction because my relationship with you is not a mercantile relationship. In a mercantile relationship, you do something for me and I do something for you, and that's our relationship. You stop doing something for me, the relationship's over. You broke your contract. But that's not our relationship. The relationship is you're the master and I'm the servant and that's it. There's nothing else between us. So that's this sense, that's a Vaikuntha sense of proprietorship. And the intimacy of love in Vrindavan is this really profound, intense sense that Krishna is my everything. And everything I have is dedicated to him. That's my possessiveness. That's this intense love feeling. And they're willing to sacrifice everything for Krishna. The example that Prabhupada would give is, if a house is on fire, the father will go into the house and risk his life to save a family member. Because that's his life, is the family member. So his life is the family member. Not, you know, what's in the house. It's the family member. So, the possessiveness of love in Vrindavan is Krishna's everything. And they can't depart from that. It's specifically saying that the Brahmanas, they were influenced by the love of Nanda and Jasoda like that. Nanda and Jasoda didn't consider anything. The Brahmanas were considering, maybe, but that maybe consideration just served to increase their sense of possessiveness. Like the rain coming down in the Kandava forest, it just serves to increase the forest fire. Nice example. I got a little carried away with the Kandava forest story, but it's a nice story. Let's see if there's some discussion. Anyone here in the room would like to share something? Discuss something. What we've been doing is I should have said this at the beginning. I'm relying on the people who are here to ask some questions because then it gives time for the online people to send in a text message question. So come up with something if you don't have something. Comment or question?
She's 9 years old. We have twins. They're twins. And when she was 6 years old, she asked me about, you know, where was I before I was born to you? And she was wondering, and I was taken by surprise because I didn't know what to tell her. So she was wondering, her mind was curious, what was she before she was born?
Do you remember that question when you were six? You don't even remember the question. Okay. Do you have an answer? Well, let's do this. The question itself implies that you understand you're not your body. Correct? Because if you were somewhere else before you were born, that means the body didn't exist before you were born. It came into existence when you were born. So you're a spirit soul. That's who you are. In a temporary body. Now, not only temporary body, but you got a nice dress on and you get a little cold. So you got a little jacket on and, but you're not the jacket. You're not the dress. You're not the body. You're the soul within. So where were you before? It's a question of modes of nature and karma. You know what the word karma means? Karma? Karma means action. When you do something, that's karma. And then there's a reaction for what you do that's also karma. It's like a knife that has two blades. This side and that side. The cutting side and the cutting side are on both sides. So what you do is karma. And the reaction for what you do is karma. You do good things, you get good things coming back. You do bad things, you cause pain and suffering to others, that pain and suffering comes back to you in equal measure. Kindness comes back to you in equal measure. That's karma. So depending upon one's past karma, one gets a body now. And then modes of nature, just like using these same examples, goodness, like compassion, or kindness, or cleanliness, or honesty, or truthfulness, those are qualities of goodness. And one who lives their life by the qualities of goodness, they go to a higher situation. And those that live their life by qualities of anger, violence, hatred, depression, and those kind of, you know, lower modes of nature, then the life form that one takes is a lower life form. According to those two principles, karma, action-reaction, and modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. I'm going like this. Goodness is higher. Below that is passion. Below that is ignorance. So depending upon past modes of nature and karma, that tells where you were before, that then determines who you are today. Now, one thing for sure, you know, where you were before is uncertain to like pinpoint it. But for sure, there's some goodness there because you're born in a nice family with nice mother and father. And here you are, you know, a 6-year-old asking about who was I in my previous life means there's some continuation of spiritual development from previous life. To ask a question like that, in your previous life, you were interested in cultivating spiritual knowledge, spiritual wisdom. And here you are, you're 9 years old, and hearing stories about Krishna. Now that's a devotional past taking place in present. It's also going to determine where you'll go after this. Not only when you're, you know, 18 or 38, you know, but where you're going after this lifetime depends upon what you're absorbed in consciousness-wise in this lifetime. So where were you before this birth? Some place where there was some spiritual, some place where there's some mode of goodness, some place where there's likely human form of life that's now continuing in this life, making further progress. Okay.
Just one question. So what was Krishna's, again, this relates to my son who just turned into a teenager. But is there, can you share any story when Krishna was a teenager, young teenager?
Yeah. We had this really detailed description of Krishna's feature. When Krishna went from Vrindavan to Mathura, so look at your son. Krishna was born in the prison house of Kamsa, son of Vasudeva and Devaki. The very night that he was born, the request was that he be taken out of Mathura from the prison house to the side of Yashoda, placed there, and the female child brought back. And Krishna said, don't worry, the guards will fall asleep. And don't worry, the locks on the door will open. And don't worry, it's a stormy night, but everything will be okay. You'll be able to take me across the river Jamuna. And everything worked out fine. So he spent his childhood in Vrindavan. When he was 12, in 8 months, something like that, is when he was invited by Kamsa to come to Mathura and take part in a festival. The plan was to try to kill him. So when he was reunited with his mother and father, Vasudeva and Devaki, he was just turning 13. His Kaishora age began at that time. Now, it's not exactly, you know, Krishna Janmashtami time when Krishna killed Kamsa, but very close. And his bodily feature is described. His bodily feature didn't change from what he looked like when he was 12, 13. And the evidence given is when Krishna, after some time, went to Dwarka from Mathura, Dwarka, and there he married 16,000 queens and expanded himself into 16,000 forms. His first queen was Rukmini, and their first son was Pradyumna. So when Pradyumna was 12 years old and he came into Krishna's inner chamber, the ladies, he looked so much like Krishna, they thought it was Krishna. Which and then is indicating that although Krishna was now so many years old, his features were like that of a 12-year-old. Now, his activities as a teenager started with going to school. Because when he was living in Vrindavan, he didn't go to school. He was out doing the family business, which was taking care of the calves and then taking care of cows. He didn't go to school. But when he went to Mathura, under the care of his Kshatriya parents, Vasudeva and Devaki, one of the first things is, gosh, we got to send him to school. So Krishna selected his school teacher. The school teacher was Sandipani Muni, and off he went to study with Sandipani Muni. That was one of the first things he did as a teenager. Study at the school of Sandipani Muni, and he learned really quickly. Then he came back to Mathura, so he spent some more time in Mathura. And he had a very dear friend, of the same age. The dear friend's name was Uddhava. Krishna's father was named Vasudev. Vasudev had a brother. They had a brother. And Devabhaga was his brother's name, and his brother had a son of the same age as Krishna. His name is Uddhava. So Krishna and Uddhava were buddies. They're like cousins. And very dear. Very dear to one another. Like Arjuna. Very dear to Krishna. So Uddhava, one of the things that Krishna did was he sent Uddhava as a teenager to give a message to the gopis in Vrindavan about, you know, whatever the message had to say, many things. He knew that their feelings were, he has similar feelings. He had to stay there in Mathura and take care of some of the demons that were harassing the royal family, and soon he would come, and so many things. So Uddhava was the message carrier. And it's a very celebrated section of the Bhagavatam, chapter 46, 10th canto. So those are some of the things Krishna did as a teenager.
This is Srikant Prabhu from Naperville. Couple of days back, I chastised my 16-month-old Yadunandana when his mother was away for not having prasadam. Since then, I've had a sense of guilt for my actions. Can I justify that it's a fatherly love similar to what Mother Yashoda felt when she reprimanded baby Krishna?
No. Our reprimand is coming from the modes of nature, and Mother Yasoda's reprimand's not coming from the modes of nature.
And this is Giri Prabhu. I forget. Giridhar Prabhu. Doing any activity, can we find out humility factor in it? At start the intent is there, while acting I may feel it's lost. How can I know?
Well, how can I know? This is a real simple answer is, each of us, there's something of a mix of desire to be in service to Krishna, and the other side is, guna and karma, the modes of nature, and, you know, selfishness. So, assume that there's a mix. How can we know? Just assume that there's a mix. And what we want to do is go more towards, for the pleasure of Krishna, and away from the selfishness, because our real self-interest is the pleasure of Krishna. That's where real happiness is. It's where our real identity is. So how can we know? Just the degree to which the thought of Krishna's pleasure, Krishna's happiness, serving Krishna favorably, to the degree to which we're thinking like that, then you're more in the humble position, the spiritual sense of humility. When that is eclipsed or not in the state of mindfulness, then it's not the position of what real humility is. Okay?
This is Sumangala Mataji's question. How to understand Arjuna giving shelter to the demon when Krishna was punishing? Isn't that Arjuna going against Krishna's plan?
No, he knows. Arjuna has the capacity to know Krishna's heart. You and I don't, but Arjuna does. So when Arjuna does something like that, it's for the pleasure of Krishna. It's not going against Krishna. The external looks like, but internal it's not.
This is Acharya Nishta Prabhu. If in certain circumstances the end justifies the means, why do Rajarishis sometimes preserve the lives of demons? Example, Maya Danava, Kali, etc. Seems Maharaj Parikshit could have saved a lot of trouble by finishing Kali personified.
Well, it's right in the Bhagavatam purport in the first canto when Maharaj Parikshit is confronting the personality of Kali. He considers, I can't go against Krishna. Since it's Krishna's plan that this is the age of Kali, I can't finish Kali because that goes against Krishna's plan. No, and then the otherwise the answer is the same. Like, you know, did Arjuna go against what Krishna wanted to finish Maya Danava? And Arjuna gave him shelter. Now, something similar in Canto 1, Chapter 7, when Ashwatthama, Arjuna is ready to kill Ashwatthama for having killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi. And Draupadi says, don't kill him. Yudhisthira says, don't kill him. Bhima, of course, says, kill him. And Krishna says, you should kill him. So, Prabhupada explains that Krishna wanted to show the exalted nature of Arjuna's devotion, that he had the capacity to understand what Krishna wanted. So, you know, sometimes when the personality Kali is not destroyed or Maya Danava is not destroyed, it's a matter of understanding what Krishna's intention is. You know, so we're not in that position to understand Krishna's intention for the most part. You know, especially when it's these, you know, contradictory, delicate things. So we follow, but exalted souls, we follow what the codes of conduct are indicated for in general. Unless there's some direct indication otherwise.
This is Sanchari's question, Sanchari Mataji. Karma transfers and helps determine who you are in the next life. How do we understand where the tendencies we may have in this life come from? Is that different from karma?
Well, tendencies have to do with guna, not karma. Tendencies are not karmic bound. Tendencies are guna bound. And, you know, take the question of how can you trace out where does this tendency or that tendency come from? That's not within our present capacity. The principle is past association with modes determines our present tendency for association with modes. Okay, that's it. Anything else? You're good? Okay, thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.